You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have Alistair McLeod with me once again. Now, if you are a serious investor or a serious student of markets and want to understand why markets are acting so irrationally at times, so that you can better prepare and withstand the government and central bank carnage that they are creating, there's no better place to turn to start with than to go to Alistair McLeod's weekly misses that are published every Thursday at goldmoney.com. Specifically, you need to click on the research page at Gold Money and then click on the insights page to read Alistair's weekly comments. And so I'm really pleased to have him with us today. We want to talk about the dollar's debt trap. And thanks so much for joining me, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
It is always great to have you with us. And I'd like to go back to this August 15, 1971, President Nixon caused the U.S. to default on its obligation under the post-World War II Bretton Woods Agreement to exchange an ounce of gold for every $35 of paper money that foreign central banks sent back to the U.S. Treasury. But on that date, August 15, 1971, and I remember it as if it was yesterday almost, President Nixon made a speech on television that he said that, well, due to speculators, he blamed speculators for a drain in the gold leaving the U.S. Coffers. He said it was only a temporary thing. He was only temporarily closing the gold window. Of course, here we are 50 years later, and there still is no gold backing of the dollar. Interestingly enough, you know, last evening, Tucker Carlson, a popular show here in Fox, it seemed as though Tucker Carlson, it's hard to believe, still believes that the dollar is backed by gold. It's incredible. But anyway, Alistair, how could you I'm just wondering how the United States could get away with just unilaterally saying, well, we're not going to pay you gold anymore. I mean, it's like, I guess we were the most powerful country in the world. Maybe that's the answer. But what are your thoughts on that? And what was Europe's reaction?
I have two thoughts. I mean, firstly, you're right. America it was then and still is the most powerful country in the world. And, you know, we deny that at our peril. And the second thought I have is, and this is not unique to the U.S. government, but all governments basically tell lies. So, I mean, well, we call it propaganda. Let's put it that way. Or spin. Uh-huh. There was a British civil servant who described it absolutely perfectly. He said, this was actually in a trial in Australia when we tried to stop a book called Spycatcher being released, mm-hmm. which was all about MI5. Mm-hmm. And he described what he had said earlier as being economical with the truth. And I think that actually is absolutely spot on. All governments do this, I'm afraid. It comes with the government territory. And really, I think what happened was that they got to a point where the $35 level was completely indefensible. I mean, you know a lot about this, Jay, and you will recall that in the late 60s, the London gold pool failed. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning, really, of what led up to that fateful day in August 1971. Mm-hmm. And I think you know, you can sort of stand back and look at it from the point of view of the Triffin dilemma. I mean, mm-hmm. the Triffin dilemma basically says that, if you're going to provide the reserve currency, then you have got to make reserve currency available for foreigners. And mm-hmm. the way you do that is basically by being irresponsible in economic terms and mm-hmm. running deficits. And America had been doing this basically to finance, well, not only the Second World War, but also the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. And of course, it wasn't too surprising, I suppose, that there were an awful lot of dollars in effect printed for export, never to or never meant to be seen in the U.S. economy. And quite naturally, these were repatriated by countries like France, who were the power in Indochina going back to before the Second World War. So this was, if you like, the culmination of a series of events that was leading to the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement. And what you do, and they were very clever, actually. What they did was they spun this another way, and they said, right, you know, okay, it's a temporary suspension, but this very quickly changed into the dollar replaced gold as the reserve currency, or the reserve money. And they did this basically by denying that gold had any role in international money thereafter. But despite that, central banks have held on to their gold, because it is the only form of money for which there is no counterparty risk. And so it is, if you like, as matter is to antimatter, gold is to fiat currencies. And you know, over the years, we have seen various attempts by the US government to try and knock gold off its perch. And they've done this. I mean, initially, they did some sales into the market, but those were just lapped up, particularly by the Arabs, and consequently, so they stopped doing sales to try and suppress the price, and instead they encouraged the growth of derivatives in the form of the fall of London was welcomed with open arms, and of course the development of the futures contracts on COMEX was an additional form of expansion, paper expansion, to absorb any demand for gold from people who might be worried from time to time about the international monetary system. And that basically is what they achieved.
Right. And the futures markets then, of course, as you say, that served the purpose of sort of keeping control of the price of gold and keeping it so that it doesn't cause, I guess, so that the result is not that people stop losing confidence in the paper currency, but continue to believe in it. Because if gold, you know, if gold surged much higher than paper, people would obviously want to jump on that train, wouldn't they?
Well, yes, there's that. But I think from the government's point of view, there is another aspect, and that is a rising gold price is a vote against the dollar. And that's something which the authorities very, very strongly resisted. They did not. I don't know that it matters quite so much now, but they certainly did not want to see a rising gold price. And so they would do anything to try and ensure that gold was sidelined. I mean, do you remember, you know, there were various people saying it was a pet rock. I think Paul asked Bernanke, you know, a question about gold. And, you know, Bernanke sort of looked a bit nonplussed and, you know, tried to dismiss it as, you know, a complete irrelevance.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is a bit silly because actually, if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, there is an item in there which is a promissory note from the U.S. Treasury covering 8,100 odd tons of gold, which is worth a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, so, it sure is.
You know, that's something which I really think was a bit silly of Mr. Bernanke to just dismiss in such an offhand manner.
Oh, it would seem so. Well, in any event, Nixon declared after he shut the gold window that we're all Keynesians now. And Keynesian economics became sort of a religion, I would say. It was established before then, but it really came into vogue. And with the blessing of a so-called conservative Nixon Republican, we're all Keynesians now, he said. And ever since that, Keynesian economics has been what I think of as an economic religion. Can you comment on how the general acceptance of Keynesian economics really played into the hands of the inflation that followed? In the 1970s, of course, we had double-digit inflation. I like to remind my listeners that my first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage. Wasn't allowed to prepay, by the way, for a number of years either. But anyway, maybe just comment on that, because there is this I mean, everybody that gets a university degree is trained in Keynesian economics. That is, I mean, not everybody, but Austrian economics is a free market system, which is never taught. What impact? I mean, it must have had a major impact on the way we think of things today. Today, AOC and Nancy Pelosi seem to think there's no end to the amount of money. There's no limits to the amount of money. It's almost as if God has left heaven and come to Washington, and he's got control of physics and the monetary system now.
So Yes, indeed. I mean, basically, what you're looking at is the difference between free markets, which you referred to, which basically allows individuals to make the choices which really set the economic agenda. That's individuals. That is the public. That is the consumer. It is the producer, being dancing to the tune of the consumer, mm-hmm. without regulation, without regulators telling the producer what he should produce and the consumer what he should consume. The Keynesian approach was really a statist approach. The state is, if you like, the most important element in the whole economy, and the money, fiat currency, is the statist, and all variation, all human desire, even time itself, is expunged from Keynesian economics, and this allows the introduction of mathematics, so that things like, you've got things like GDP and so on and so forth, and they're expected to grow. Now, GDP growth, all that is actually is the growth of the quantity of money recorded in GDP. It doesn't tell right. tells you nothing about, the quality of the transactions or, what people want. It can't do that because there is no way that the past can be just extrapolated into the future, mm-hmm. and this is where the whole thing is wrong. So the mathematical approach was essentially a statist approach, mm-hmm. and when Nixon said we're all Keynesians now, in effect he was dismissing completely personal choice, and we're living with the consequences of that now, of course. And it's gone even further than that, because the idea that inflation is merely rising prices and that can be somehow controlled by policy is really a huge, huge mistake. It's gone to the point where there is absolutely no connection at all in the official mind between the quantity of money and the purchasing power of the currencies. I mean, in another note, I pointed out that Bernanke's Jackson Hole speech was about monetary policy. And, money was not mentioned once in that speech, which is an extraordinary thing. And that is actually a measure of where we've got to in terms of trying to understand, what inflation is. And my goodness, what a mistake. I mean, to sort of think that, you can look at, supply factors and demand factors and conclude that inflation is transient is a huge error. It's a major mistake. And of course, the problem here is not only is the Fed making a huge mistake in terms of trying to control inflation, understanding what inflation is, but it's going to be too late for them to really wake up and do something about it. So we are going to see inflation rise. Why? Because broad money grew by over 25% last year. The consequences are now coming through now that the lockdowns have been lifted. So, this is a very serious time. And already we see what, people refer to as stagflation. You've got inflation roaring, but at the same time, the economy isn't. So, but anyone who actually understands what drives the purchasing power of the currency will understand that these are precisely the conditions that happen in any great inflation, and we're in the early stages of it.
You mentioned it's too late. I mean, certainly I remember, and you're old enough to remember as well, that Paul Volcker in 1980, he took his foot off the gas pedal and allowed, and slowed down at least the money growth, the money supply growth, and we had these enormous rates of interest rates, and of course, I think we got closer to the real price of capital during that time. We could afford it. It was a deep recession. I remember it quite well. But actually, it sort of paved the way for a long period of low inflationary growth, if you define inflation by price increases, I don't know that I would say it's low inflation, because as you know, money supply grew dramatically under Reagan's years during the 80s as well. But what do you say to people that say, see, the federal, you know, they point to that and all the other issues, with the dot-com bust and the real estate bust of 2008, and they say, see, the Fed always comes through. It always does well. It always turns things around for us. And what do you say to people that say that?
Certainly that has been the case to date. But we've now embarked on a scale of money printing that we haven't seen before. And I think to rely on the thought that the Fed actually know what they're doing and they're going to steer us through these choppy waters into some sort of, future calm and, with the sun shining on the water and it's all, all the rough stuff's going to go away. I mean, I think this is huge wishful thinking. I know it's wishful thinking. And, we are, fueling this wishful thinking, of course, is a bubble in financial assets. Mm-hmm. People are fully invested in the concept that the Fed can never get it wrong. I'm sorry, but, they're talking their book. This is a very dangerous situation, and it behoves anyone, I think, who has financial assets to stand back and think a bit about what is actually going on and what the consequences are likely to be.
Right. Well, Volcker could raise rates at that time. As I mentioned, it was painful. But it sort of paved the way for a couple of decades of growth. But we can't do that now. I think everybody sort of realizes that rates can't go up much at all before the whole thing comes toppling down. But yet you're insisting, you're quite convinced that rates will rise. The Fed will not be able to stop them. I guess because they won't be able to stop inflation. Is that your idea? Inflation is going to rise. That is inflation in the way that people understand it. That is rising prices. I mean, they don't see a stock market that is way overpriced as being inflation. Oh, it is. And a bond market the same way. But when the consumer starts to see inflation, prices rising dramatically, is that when we're going to see the Fed lose control of the bond market?
Well, absolutely, because the point about it is that this idea that inflation is rising prices is a complete misunderstanding of actually what's happening. Inflation is, it's always a monetary thing. I mean, Milton Friedman said, it's all a monetary thing. I mean, where he was wrong is that it's not just a monetary thing. It is mm-hmm. also, a public perception thing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the point is that when you see the general level of prices rising, which you can't incidentally quantify, but when you see the general level of prices rising, actually what's happening is the purchasing power of the currency is going down.
Right.
Now, going back to this Triffin dilemma thing, mm-hmm. We're at the point really where foreigners now own roughly $32 trillion worth. That's 1.5 times U.S. GDP of financial assets. Now, they're sitting there exposed to dollars, and they see the dollar going down. Now, their own currency may be going down as well. But if you're a business manufacturing things, what are you seeing? You are seeing you've got an awful lot of dollars, and commodity prices, the things that you need to buy to make things, the cost of labor and all the rest of it, you're going to reduce your exposure to fiat currencies. And that is, that basically is what happens. And I would also say that the other problem this time, compared with the time of Volcker incidentally sacrificed the savings and loan industry.
Yes, that's true.
That fell apart. But today, I mean, we're now looking at including a money, the currency in the system is credit or debt, if you like. Mm-hmm. And the total amount of public sector debt in the U.S. economy is in the region of $100 trillion. Sorry, not public, but the total of public and private sector debt plus money is around about $100 trillion. And that's not including shadow banking, which according to the Financial Securities Board, which does the research on these things, they reckon that there's another $52 trillion of shadow banking in the U.S. economy. Now, not all of that is if you like, extra credit being produced, if you like, by the banking process, but sort of off balance sheet. But around about $20 trillion of it probably is. So this is a major, major, major problem. And it's going to take a very small rise in interest rates, basically, to undermine the whole financial system.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things also that one of your ideas that seems to run counter to what some of my friends, especially those that are more of the deflationary school, believe, they're sort of thinking is, yes, the system will ultimately collapse, but it will be the dollar will be the last one standing. You're sort of suggesting that the dollar is likely to be the leader of the destruction of the existing monetary system.
Yes, when you get a crisis in the currencies that suffer most are the ones which are most owned. Because basically what happens is that people who own foreign currencies will liquidate those currencies in order to bring their money home. Mm-hmm. Now, the foreigners owning $32 trillion, that is the one currency. The dollar is the one currency which is overowned. The others are, I mean, if you look at the euro, that is probably underowned, to which, you know, and I mean, the fundamentals for the euro are worse probably than for the dollar. But what matters is the currency flows. And I think, you know, we just have to pay attention to where the positions are. Everybody's got dollars. Not everybody has euros. Not everybody has yen. And indeed, very few people have Chinese yuan. That's probably going to be the strong currency in a currency collapse.
Right. Very interesting. And we had Frank Holmes on our show recently, and he was talking about the Chinese going to a cryptocurrency backed by gold. Does that seem feasible to you? I'm going to have Frank on to talk more about it sometime in the near future, but any thoughts on that? And the second thing, real quickly, I'd just like to mention that the cryptos haven't done well in the last few days, and gold has been relatively strong in light of the during the equity market weakness.
Well, the cryptos are not money. That's the first thing I would say. But gold has a long history, like 5 millennia of being money. And importantly, when government money fails, it comes back as money. So, you know, anyone who thinks that crypto is money is actually taking a very speculative bet. I'll leave it at that. I could go into a real proper description as to why it will never work. But as to the Chinese having a gold-backed crypto, that, again, I think is very, very much speculation. Yeah. The problem, I think, with central bank digital currencies is that in order to get them to work, there's going to have to be a long period of testing the things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Chinese allegedly have sort of had trials in certain areas and so on and so forth. But that's a very different thing from rolling this out, if you like, on a complete basis. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see why they should have a crypto which is gold backed. I mean, it just doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. I think they will continue with the yuan until you get a currency crisis, which in my view will be a dollar crisis, and it will be sparked by people trying to get out of financial assets and out of the currency, very much in the John Law model, if you like, that happened exactly 300 years ago, because that the Mississippi bubble, when that collapsed, that killed the currency. I think we've got the potential for the same thing today. You know, and the Chinese, I think, you know, they're not going to do anything until that has sort of suddenly hit everybody. And then there will be a big rethink about what now.
Yeah, indeed. We're close to something like that, Alistair, really close.
I believe so, yes. I mean, the first rise in interest rates and indeed the anticipation of it will start undermining financial asset values. And as soon as they start slipping, then I think there are going to be enormous problems. The Fed is going to lose control over the situation.
All right, we'll have to leave it go at that. Well, I'd like to just say, though, folks, that go read Alistair's Dollar Debt Trap article of August 19th at goldmoney.com, and there you'll get an awful lot more than we could talk about today. One thing he pointed out there was how much better gold performed than real estate. So just one tidbit amongst many there. Thanks so much, Alistair, for being with us today. Always great to have you. Folks, that is all the time we have today. So next week we're going to have John Rubino, Michael Oliver will be back. John Watson of NV Gold also will join me. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.